We have with us once again John Parrish, co-editor at Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
All right, no Maria this morning.
She was doing her taxes last night, so she got a hangover.
Yeah, she's got quite the paperwork to fill out, so nothing that you or I need to ever worry about. All right, let's start with local and Olympia. Things are still busy down in Olympia.
Busier than ever, in fact. The state legislature is trying to cobble together a budget in its last days. Things look likely to be headed to a special session at this point, but it's also, we had a critical deadline last week for advancement of a non-budget related legislation, and so a lot going on. The state senate released its version of how to fund the $5 billion shortfall in the state budget this year, after the House had already done so. And the Senate's version of the budget, $4.8 billion in cuts, that's $3 million more than the House. The difference being that they did not accept the House numbers on there being a $300 million savings associated with the liquor privatization initiative being spearheaded by Costco. There's some question as to whether the state Senate will embrace that liquor privatization initiative or not, or whether it's simply saying, yeah, we still like it, we just don't think it'll save any money to not have any revenue from hard liquor sales. So the main differences in the Senate budget, some additional cuts to K through 12 education, much more cuts as well from higher education, bigger tuition hikes, for example, from 13% in the House budget to $16,000, or 16% rather, in the Senate version, which would bring tuition, say, at UW to well over $10,000 a year for in-state tuition. And you really wonder why tuition hikes, if other state fees, like, for example, the fees that are assessed to banks or oil companies or whatnot, Republicans are claiming that those fees can't be raised because of I-1053, the Iman initiative that requires, two-thirds, legislative approval for tax increases or a public vote, why that wouldn't apply to tuition increases as well. I just don't know why that wouldn't apply. Maybe it doesn't apply if you're a lowly student and therefore don't have, corporate bank accounts or something. I don't know.
Because they seem to be a voting block, so.
Well, the ones who are 18 anyway, yeah. So the Senate version of the budget is out now. Another move in the Senate, Phil Rockefeller, a Democrat from Bainbridge Island, and 12 other Senate colleagues calling for a referendum on the ballot this fall to revise I-1053 to make it a simple majority for eliminating tax exemptions. In other words, enabling the state legislature to vote without the two-thirds requirement when it comes to eliminating corporate loopholes on taxes, which a lot of Democrats in Olympia, in the state legislature, have been saying, look, it's insane that we're paying out all of these, arcane industries, we're losing revenue from these, and meanwhile we're gutting basic services to the state, in exchange for things that wouldn't seem to be as high a priority, like, promoting this or that, home brewing industry or thing, different things that don't have that much of an impact on the economy.
The candy industry.
Although that went to the voters last fall too. So, we have that complication on that one. But, so that initiative, or that call for a referendum would only require a majority in order to put it on the ballot. But we'll see whether the Democratic leadership wants to go along with that or not. Chances are at this point they would not. But we'll see. Meantime, state medical marijuana dispensary legislation, did pass both the House and, did pass the House on Monday, meaning that, it's awaiting Governor Gregoire's signature at this point. And then the poop hit the fan. There was a letter requested by Gregoire from the U.S. attorneys for Western and Eastern Washington, based in Seattle and Spokane. And that letter was released on Friday, saying that the federal government would basically prosecute anybody who tried to operate a medical marijuana dispensary in Washington State, and would also prosecute state employees who helped set them up. This came as a shock. One of the organizers of the effort to pass this legislation told me that Jenny Durkin, who's the attorney for U.S. attorney for Western Washington, that she and Gregoire had been in conversations as long as 6 weeks ago. So it really wasn't at all clear why Gregoire waited until after the legislature had passed the bill before releasing this information, or before expressing her reservations around this. The move is widely seen as Gregoire attempting to generate cover for her to veto the bill, which is something that very few people saw coming. And there's been some speculation as well in the Stranger and other sources that one of the reasons for this is Gregoire is looking, she's widely expected not to run for re-election in 2012, and a lot of speculators think that she has her eye on an appointment in the Obama administration, should it be elected to a second term next year. And therefore, she's trying to forestall criticism at a confirmation hearing in Washington, D.C. that may or may not happen, and for that reason is willing to hang medical marijuana patients in Washington State out to dry, even though there's been a record of Bill Richardson, who was the governor in New Mexico during that state's approval of medical marijuana dispensary legislation. Several other states have already done this without any kind of interference from the federal government and without any political repercussion for their governors. So it's really not clear what Gregoire's objections to this are, other than to note that she did serve two terms as state attorney general, and during that time was very tight with state law enforcement lobbyists and agencies, many of whom opposed this bill. So
does that mean then that they could potentially prosecute the legislators, since they would, in effect, be helping set up these facilities?
No, they talk specifically about state employees who tried to implement the legislation, as opposed to those who actually passed it to begin with. So no, I think there might be widespread approval for actually prosecuting the legislators, although not necessarily
for that reason.
For
other reasons.
Yeah.
Okay. And, well, then the person doing that potentially would be Rob McKenna, but you have info about his activities this week that have nothing to do with that.
Yeah, well, I mean, Rob McKenna has always tried to, not directly anyway. Rob McKenna has always tried to present himself as this reasonable, independent-minded Republican who's not like those Tea Party crazies. All the meanwhile, over the past year or so, especially by doing things like joining the lawsuit by other states against the Obama's health care reform and some other very obviously politically motivated moves that he's made, he's been sending a lot of signals to the Tea Party that he is in fact not only running for governor, but that he's going to do so as a very conservative Republican. So he sent an email out to supporters this week to promote a tax day rally that he and a few Tea Party supporters held yesterday in Bellevue, which is kind of odd because tax day this year wasn't yesterday. It was on Monday, so he actually got that wrong, or actually the organizers of the rally did. And apparently the organizers of the rally, there were only about 100 people there and 35 or so counter-protesters. But McKenna in his email spent a lot of time trashing the protesters in Olympia last week to demand budget cuts, calling them a mob, far-left extremists, hardcore tax and spend advocates, and various other things, and implying that average taxpayers who have jobs and families can't protest in Olympia, therefore suggesting that the people who were protesting in Olympia last week don't have jobs and don't have families and presumably are too lazy to do anything but go down to Olympia and protest for the government handouts. Of course, if they really were lazy, they wouldn't have made the trip to Olympia to begin with. But it really does point up that when McKenna starts running for governor next year, as he's again widely expected to do, He's either trying to protect himself against a primary challenge from the Tea Party, or he's expecting to actively run as a Tea Party activist, which is very much not the image that he has courted during his time on King County Council and then as State Attorney General. So, very interesting series of moves on McKenna's part.
All right. Moving on, a second anti-tunnel initiative appears to have got the necessary signatures.
Yeah, they turned in enough signatures, I-101, to get on the ballot for this fall, although they initially had not, and then they turned in another 3,000 on Monday, and that should be enough to qualify them. City Attorney Peter Holmes has filed suit to block this initiative from appearing on the ballot this year, just as he did with the previous initiative, and using the same argument that the city council's passage of agreements with the state to implement the building of the tunnel are not legislation. They're administrative in that they're implementing agreements rather than creating law, and therefore not subject to a referendum. This is a position that has the support of a majority, a supermajority, really, of the city council, who has been voting for the tunnel all along, and it make it very difficult for either initiative to appear on the ballot. Now, if they do appear on the ballot, it may well be in August rather than in November. The court that is hearing these lawsuits, or hearing the first lawsuit, and is expected to do the same with the second, agreed this week to expedited hearings so that it will rule in mid-May. That would be in time for the city to place the ballot, to place the measure for the first initiative on the ballot in August, which it would prefer to do. Now, turnout in August for the primary is substantially less than it is for for the November election, so it's not clear whether that would be an advantage to anti-tunnel activists, who tend to be more passionate about this issue than people in support of the tunnel, or pro-tunnel supporters, who tend to have a lot more money than people who are opposed to the tunnel. So we'll see. As we mentioned before, my day job at this point is makes it wise for me not to comment on local affairs in issues of this sort. So I'm not going to say what I think of these initiatives, but because it should be in no means construed as being the opinion of or coordinated with what I'm doing for the city council campaign that I'm working on. But suffice it to say that if it does go on the ballot in August, I think that's going to increase the turnout for the August primary by quite a bit.
Okay. Moving on to national, President Obama coming out with a speech this week about the budget.
Yeah, Obama revealing his proposal for budget cuts for 2012 in response to Representative Paul Ryan's unveiling a proposal last week that would have essentially dismantled the health, Medicare and Medicaid and a number of other government programs. And the House Republicans doubling down in response on Thursday, passing along strict party lines, not one Democrat voted in favor of it, passing a 2012 budget blueprint that's expected to be the starting point for their negotiating on a 2012 budget, in which they called for $5.8 trillion in cuts to federal spending over the next 10 years. It would essentially dismantle Medicare and Medicaid, putting Medicare into the hands of private plans for seniors who need health care, which is most seniors. Of course, with no cost control associated with that, I can't imagine that's going to be very popular with most seniors. Meanwhile, the Republican plan would cut taxes for the wealthy and also hike Pentagon spending. It doesn't really touch Pentagon spending, which accounts for over half of the federal budget at this point. Really, when they're calling for $5.8 trillion in cuts, it's almost entirely to social programs, to regulatory agencies that do things like protect the environment or food safety or worker safety. Basically all of the things that might get in the way of big business or help people who aren't a big business. That's what the Republicans want to cut, and they don't want to touch any of the rest of it. Now, Obama, in his budget speech, was actually, by Obama's standards, remarkably assertive and remarkably direct in ripping Ryan's budget proposal and the GOP's budget proposal, and said he wouldn't back down on his demand that the Bush tax cuts for the wealthy be allowed to expire in 2012. That sets up a very likely confrontation all over again for a government shutdown, not just for the 2012 budget, which Congress is supposed to pass this fall, but also for extending the national debt, because the United States is expected to reach its debt ceiling by the middle of next month in May, and will default on its loans without Congress acting to extend that that debt ceiling, which Republicans are opposed doing without what is very likely to be yet another round of budget blackmail. So expect this to be a continuing story next month, and yet another very tiresome series of confrontations and a potential government shutdown again next month.
All right. The vote on the budget plan is just, it's more symbolic than, I mean, there's nothing solid in there that is binding.
Well, there's no, you, in order for the House budget plan to become law, it would have to be passed by the Senate and signed into law by Obama, neither of which are going to happen. You know, the Senate, Harry Reid, the Senate Majority Leader, the Democrat from Nevada, said flat out that it was a non-starter and that it wouldn't even be considered by the Senate. Nonetheless, it's expected to be the negotiating baseline for when the House and the Senate do pass their competing versions of spending bills and of the budget. And you know, expect the House Republicans to continue to refer back to this, and expect Democrats as well to keep referring back to it, because you can be sure that going into the elections next year, you know, the fact that every Republican in the Senate, in the House rather, voted to dismantle Medicare is something that, in particular, is something that the Democrats are going to point out over and over and over again.
Yeah, I'm sure the bumper stickers are being printed as we speak. All right, let's move on. Developments this week in regards to Arizona's immigration bill?
Yeah, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals for the Western United States blocked immigration of SB 1070 this week. That expected to be once again kicked up to a higher court, perhaps the Supreme Court, the Arizona continuing to appeal that. Meanwhile, with the legislature in Georgia passing a nearly identical bill that would critics are concerned would also lead to racial profiling by mandating local law enforcement to arrest anybody that they suspect of being an illegal immigrant. Now, again, how you tell somebody is an illegal immigrant other than by looking at their skin color and deciding that they aren't American or are speaking a language other than English, you know, is anybody's guess. But in fact, the concern has been very much that it would lead to a lot of racial profiling. So much so, in fact, that in the state of Arizona, in the years since SB 1070 was originally passed, Latinos in large numbers, some 100,000, not all of them Mexicans and not all of them undocumented immigrants, have left Arizona for other states or you know, for somewhere else. We don't know where they've gone, whether they've gone back to Mexico if they were from there originally, or whether they've moved elsewhere in the United States. But the point is that it's really hurting Arizona's economy. Nonetheless, a number of other states have considered proposals like this, and Georgia now becomes the second to pass it. The legislature has passed it, and the governor said later in the week that he would sign it into law, so that's probably going to happen in the next few days.
All right. Moving on, an article in the UK Guardian.
Yeah, and funny thing how this didn't show up in American media. It showed up in British media. This is a theme that we keep coming back to on this program, that, you know, if you want to read what's going on in the United States, it often helps to read foreign press, because things don't just get reported in this country. It's almost like living in the Soviet Union, where you had to listen to shortwave from other countries to find out what was happening in your own country. Anyway, BP executives were, according to emails that were obtained by The Guardian, exploring ways to influence the or take over the independent, so-called independent scientific fund that was created in the wake of the Deepwater Horizon oil spill last year in order to study the impacts of the Deepwater Horizon oil spill. Now, why the why BP might want to guide or influence or actually control the areas that those scientists study or the findings that they reach has a number of implications. Most obvious is the financial implications, because there are a number of lawsuits that are proceeding from the various states that are affected, from different federal agencies, from the commercial fisheries and a lot of other private industry interests against BP and the associated companies that were involved in the Deepwater Horizon spill. And if the scientific the independent scientific commission that was created in order to study the impacts come back saying, well, you know what, actually the oil spill was really big, but it wasn't that big a deal, and sea mammals are frolicking and the fisheries are fine and the damages really weren't that bad, then BP is going to be on the hook for a lot less money. And the biggest question in cases like this, and we certainly saw this also in the Exxon Valdez oil spill, which legally speaking is even though it's a very different kettle of fish, it's one state instead of five, and it was a one-time event and an oil spill of a defined amount of oil as opposed to a gusher that went on for months, and it was, you know, at sea level rather than on the bottom of the ocean floor. You know, despite all of those differences, legally speaking, one of the similarities is the extreme difficulty you have in actually finding what the value is of the damages. You know, who was harmed and by how much you should value the penalties for negligence or any other findings of culpability on BP or the oil owner of the oil drilling rig or some of the other companies involved. And, you know, how you value all of that is a really thorny legal issue that some very high-priced lawyers are going to be litigating over for some time to come. So the word out of the Guardian this week is that BP is trying to influence that valuation question to try and save themselves some money, and at the same time influence our scientific understanding of what the impacts of the risks of deep water oil spills might be in general. Which is also a political question, because the Obama administration has not shown very much of a willingness to more tightly regulate deep water drilling at this point.
I know BP had their shareholder meeting this last week in London, and was not open arms for the people of the Gulf states when they showed up.
I'm shocked. I'm really shocked. Why
I think the Guardian had good coverage on that too.
So. Yeah, they did. And again, that also was not well covered in the United States.
All right. Let's speaking of covered in the United States, as well as well covered in Japan, the developments this week with the analysis of the radiation levels or anticipation of radiation levels?
Yeah, we had several developments this week on the Fukushima nuclear plant crisis in Japan. Media reports in the United States focusing on iodine 131, which has been found in elevated levels all over the United States, but has only an 8-day half-life, as opposed to cesium 134 and 137, also products of the Fukushima spill, and also which have been found in the United States, including in very elevated levels in Hawaiian milk supplies. Those have not been talked about in media coverage, and those have a much longer half life. Now, they're still at levels that experts are saying are well below the thresholds at which they pose an ongoing health risk. But, you know, there are also people that you can find that tell you that, well, you know, no level of higher radiation is actually safe. It's just a question of a continuum of risks. So we'll see. But, at this point, so far, almost consistently since the beginning of the crisis with the earthquake on March 11th, media reports have been underplaying the amount of reports of how much radiation has been released, to what area, and with what level of risk to people there. The levels of radiation that have been found in offshore waters were also reported to be elevated yesterday and today in Japan, raising the risk that new leaks have sprung in Fukushima. But it's not entirely clear where those leaks might be coming from, or whether they were ongoing, or whether it was a one-time event. Meanwhile, a report in Asahi Shimbun, which is the Tokyo newspaper that's basically the Japanese equivalent of the New York Times, so it's a fairly credible source, saying that there's a secret Japanese government plan circulating that would dismantle TEPCO, the Tokyo Electric Power Company, which is the owner of Fukushima and the world's largest private supplier of electricity. It would dismantle TEPCO by forcing it in bankruptcy and restructuring its assets, which again raises the question, can you imagine the U.S. government doing anything similar with a private utility in this company, in this country, after a disaster like that? We've certainly had precedents in this country of the government intervening to stave off bankruptcy and restructure a company, but as in the case of the auto companies a couple of years ago in this country, but in those cases the management teams were by and large left intact, the restructuring was fairly minimal, and the government really didn't try to influence its the actual running of the companies. It was just supplying cash, whereas in this case the Japanese government would basically be shutting the corporation down, which again is probably the appropriate response, but one that really wouldn't be on the table in this country.
And would they be doing so and using those assets for paying for damages?
It was not clear. The Japanese report did not say that, and since it hasn't been made public yet, the plans themselves, that part's not clear.
All right.
One would hope.
Moving on, developments this week in Palestine and Israel.
Yeah, the International Solidarity Movement had another loss this week. An Italian ISM activist, Vittorio Arrigoni, was kidnapped and murdered by a fringe Palestinian group in Gaza, which was trying to pressure Hamas into releasing a militant that it had been holding prisoner. That's the third death by the nonviolent ISM movement, Rachel Corey being the first activist who was killed, and then another British activist who was killed a year later in 2004. Both of those deaths were at the hands of Israeli military. This death, on the other hand, was at the hands of fringe Palestinians who really didn't see any difference between the peace activists that are there to try and help the Palestinian cause and other Western non-Muslim people who it sees as oppressing Palestine. So it really underscores a couple of things. Number one, how dangerous it is over there and how brave it is for activists, including a number from Seattle, who go over there trying to be nonviolent shields and witnesses to try and just defuse some of the violence for ordinary Palestinians who are caught in the crossfire between all of this. The other thing that it underscores as well is I lost the train of thought there.
All right.
Well, maybe we'll come back to that, and maybe not.
Probably not.
But in any event, it was it's a tragedy.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. Just about a minute left then for a pair of studies, at least one on natural gas.
Yeah. New York Times article this week with two studies coming out that show that natural gas, due to its accidental release of methane, which is the primary ingredient in natural gas, actually does more to create greenhouse gases than burning coal. This is bad news for advocates of clean energy who have been relying on natural gas as a substitute for burning coal to try and mitigate the effects of climate change. But it turns out that natural gas may be just as destructive as burning coal is. And then we also had researchers from Australia and Europe this week finding an increase in the South Asian monsoon season as being the cause of a 20% increase over the last 10 million years in the movement of the Indian tectonic plate. This is the first time that changes in climate have been shown to influence the movement of the Earth's crust as opposed to vice versa, which raises the question that climate change impacts over the long term, which hopefully human beings will be able to survive somehow, maybe even more destructive than we initially thought. So every time we have a new scientific study like this that might involve climate change, it just seems to get worse and worse.
All right. quickly, events.
Yeah, Monday is tax day, and there will be leafleting in a number of areas at the Bank of America building in Ballard at 20th and Market at lunchtime from 11:30 to 1, from noon to 1 at Westlake Park, focusing on militarism, also Madison Valley, Rainier Valley, and Capitol Hill. More information on a lot of those can be found at the Fellowship of Reconciliation's website, wwfor.org. On Tuesday, from noon to 3, there will be a rally in support of SB 5073. That's the medical marijuana dispensary bill that will be in Olympia. There will be lobbying attention to that also as the state legislature looks at final passage of that bill. And then Friday, April 22nd, is Earth Day. So there will be a lot of events associated with that as well. Check your local listings.
All right. Talking as we do every week with Jav Parrish, co-editor of Eat the State. Where do people find Eat the State?
www.eatthestate.org. News, commentary, comics, all kinds of fun stuff. Check it out.